Hello everyone, and welcome to the Reading Party podcast with Megan and Lexi. Together, we'll watch, snack, and chat our way through books and films set in the ancient world. We bring our expertise as ancient historians to the table to dissect every detail. We hope you'll grab your favourite beverage and snacks and join us every week on this adventure. Before we start spilling the tea, a brief note on our content. The Reading Party podcast is created for adult audiences. The stories of the ancient world are full of violence and undisguised sexual content, and your hosts aren't afraid to curse up a storm. For those reasons, this podcast is not suitable for under 18s, and certain episodes may not be suitable for those living with trauma. This season, we're focusing on stories set in ancient Egypt, and we'll be bringing in guest hosts that are subject matter experts to help us really dig into the history of what we're reading and watching. With that in mind, let's get going. Lexi and I have our teas and are so ready to start spilling the tea on a ton of ancient stories. Hello everyone and welcome back to the Reading Party podcast. Today we are talking to the wonderful Cara Cooney, Egyptologist extraordinaire, and we have compiled a list of questions about, well, Egypt, but Egypt during Cleopatra's reign, because last time we spoke about the movie Cleopatra with the incomparable Elizabeth Taylor. So Cara, would you mind just giving us an introduction to yourself and tell the audience where they can find out more about you and about your work?
My name is Cara Cooney. I also publish under the name Kathleen Cooney, K-A-T-H-L-Y-N. It's my mother's fault. And I have a dual personality in the academic side is Kathleen M. Cooney. That's a Mary for the middle initial. And the popular side is Cara Cooney. But I am crossing the streams. And my next academic book will be published under Cara Cooney with American University in Cairo Press at their request. So interesting. I know. And where you can find me, so many places, but I'm most active right now on Substack and my podcast, Afterlives of Ancient Egypt. The Substack goes out every week or so, and as does the podcast. And we also have guests on like you do, but we have a lot more internal chat, I think, on different topics as well. And yeah, I've got a website, I've got a Facebook page, I've got a Twitter that is insanely political. So only go there if you want to be triggered by these things. But really, I just repost insanely political things. I don't say too much on my own. And I guess that's it. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Lexi, do you mind if I start with the first question?
Go right ahead.
Amazing. Thank you. So Cara, you've written an entire book on Egyptian queens. Would you mind just telling us before we get into Cleopatra specifically a little bit about the book and share something that you think modern conceptions of Egyptian queenship usually get wrong?
Yeah, this is something that I've been thinking a lot about lately since I came back from the International Congress of Egyptology or International Conference of Egypt, doesn't really matter, but it was in Leiden this year, happens every 4 years. And there seemed to be a lot of consternation and discourse about the power of women and how it works. And much of it was a reaction against things that I have written. My name was not mentioned in these discussions, but I was like, ooh, they're mad at me. And so let's go back to what it is that I have written and how I've become the nonfiction chick lit Egyptologist. But I've written two books about women in particular. The first one is called The Woman Who Would Be King. It was published with Crown. It's about Hatshepsut, and it is a cradle to grave kind of story, trying to, in a sense, novelize a nonfiction story and try to understand the personality or decision making or more intimate details of a person's life. Very risky experiment, but I stand by it and had a lot of fun writing that book. The next book was called When Women Ruled the World, which is a more straightforward, here are six women of ancient Egypt, five of whom became nothing less than king. And here's what their patterns are. Each woman got a chapter. I start out with what is female power? What is a patriarchy? How does female power work within a patriarchy? And I end the book with a rather dour and pessimistic statement that all of these women had to work within the patriarchal system that they were born into. None of them was able to change it. None of them was a feminist that created a new system. We can't expect them to have acted as such. And all of them were in some ways tokens of the patriarchal system, placeholders for that patriarchal system, were used by that patriarchal system, but could sometimes transcend it. And their existence as rulers within that system shows that they could certainly do it. But it also reveals the unsavory truth that many women who find their way to power do so by acting like men, working with men, and with men's agendas. Not that there's anything wrong with men. The patriarchy hurts men too, which is something I'm very clear about, particularly in my latest book, The Good Kings. But this take goes against a take of the 60s, 70s, and 80s that really wanted to highlight female power as completely positive and took on this positivist perspective of, look at how powerful Hatshepsut was. Look at how awesome she was. They don't want somebody like me coming in and saying, look, Hatshepsut was a pure traditionalist. Let's compare her to Maggie Thatcher. They don't want that at all. And it's not something that makes us feel good about our power, about ourselves. And it's something that makes a woman CEO or a woman who's worked hard in the boys' club to fight her way to the top feel good about how she's gotten there or what it means to have gotten there. And I want us to question what it means that a woman finds her way at the top of power, because so often it serves the larger system of men. And how many times have we told ourselves, oh, we've gotten to the top? Well, in the United States, we've still not had a female president, and I don't expect one anytime soon unless there's a death of the man in office, and then that might happen accidentally. But even when women find themselves at the top of a political system does not mean that they have changed that system. And that seems to have created so much of that consternation and discourse that I was talking about at the International Conference of Egyptologists, that I'm actively now getting pushback by people saying, how dare I talk about this power and problematize it in this way? And I think one of the comments was, oh, I'm so tired of people saying that these women didn't have any real power. What does that even mean? And so it's, my work is nuanced. It is saying, yes, these women individually did have great power, but as a system and as an injection into a larger system and as a legacy after their rule, their power was much more limited and their successes and triumphs were generally assigned and given to men who ruled after them, sometimes even before them. You can do this as historians. And their tragedies and failures are assigned to them individually as the cautionary tales that we must tell and then retell. Cleopatra, of course, falls into that latter category. So that's my larger take on women in power. It's not to say that the system we find ourselves in, which is patriarchal, will always be patriarchal. And we see, I think, on the ground, the system changing, but I think we can also see the pushback by the conservative factions that don't want this system to change. That pushback is very real. So I think if listeners want to know more about what I think the future holds for power and systems of power, particularly in the United States, they should look at my last chapter of The Good Kings, where I really try to examine, really using these Egyptian women and male kings as well, what it means to live in a patriarchal system and how we can possibly transcend it. So I know this is a very long answer, Megan. I'm sorry. But that kind of sets up where my work finds itself. Yeah.
No, it's a perfect answer. And it actually leads very nicely into my next question, which is, how were women able to wield power in Egypt in this highly patriarchal system?
It's one of the most interesting questions that you could possibly ask. And I've built an entire class around this question at UCLA. At UCLA, we have a course called Women in Power in the Ancient World. I don't include the New World because we only have a 10-week quarter. And while there were women in power in the ancient Aztec, Mayan, and the many Peruvian societies of antiquity, there's no room, there's no time. So in this course, I'll have a week on Greece, a week on Rome, a week on the Levant, a week on Mesopotamia, a week on India, China, Persia even, and then the rest of the time is devoted to Egypt. And it is an extraordinary fact that Egypt allowed more women into the highest positions of power, named as such, with a reasonable regularity over their 3,000-year existence. And that even when there's a Macedonian occupation of Egypt, the Ptolemaic dynasty, you see that female power, which was not non-existent in the Macedonian Greek system, but certainly not as prevalent, it comes to the fore because Egypt demands it. And then you're like, well, what is it about Egypt? Are the Egyptians like more enlightened? Do they have like a different DNA? Well, no, obviously. The Egyptians are not more enlightened than anybody else. They're humans just like we are. But their system of government, economy, politics, society lends itself to a family-based dynastic authoritarian system of power. The Nile itself, and I've written about this in my book on ancient Egyptian society that I edited with Nadia Ben-Marzouk and Danny Candelora. It's a Routledge book. You can find that anywhere books, academic books are sold. But I talk about the Nile being a simultaneously unifying and disunifying force socially, such that when it's the flood is perfect, you can combine this place into one unit and you can tax, you can collect tax. If you have the nice boat that's not going to get the grain moldy, you can go up and down and collect all of your taxes. And this artery will unite this place in a way that nothing else can. When the Nile is low, then you're disunified, you're decentralized, and you rely on a series of mini authoritarian powers up and down the Nile. But the Nile itself allows this for those people who are farming, for those people who are living along the Nile, not for the desert dwellers. It allows this overlay of power. And that power often finds itself acting through a family system. And a family system has to have women in it because otherwise you're not going to have another lineage. You got to have somebody to have sex with. You got to have another generation. And with those women in that system, the great irony or tragedy of the story is that the reason women wielded so much power in ancient Egypt is that we're part of authoritarian systems in which when something happened to the masculine entity at the head of the system, the tip of the spear, the head of the pyramid, whatever analogy you want to use, the best alternative was not another man who would destabilize that authoritarian system, destabilize that dynasty, threaten that family. It was a woman within that family. She was the best option. She was the best way to maintain and keep that authoritarian power. And you can see this working within Egypt quite effectively. Sometimes the family is very powerful. Sometimes it's not. There are times in Egypt when there's a more decentralized institutional systemic kind of power, a more military community of practice kind of power. So let's just compare the 18th dynasty as a whole to the very end of the 18th dynasty and then the 19th and 20th dynasties. The kings of the 19th dynasty are coming from a military community of practice. We have texts that talk about them having been great generals coming from the Northeastern Delta, immigrants who get the job done, according to the Hamilton musical or something like that. It's kind of cool to see these people coming in from the Eastern Delta and then making themselves more Egyptian than Egyptian, but they're military men. And the 19th and 20th dynasties, Tawasret excluded, have very little place for women in power. Even with that military community of practice, however, Tawasret finds her way to the head position as nothing less than king. That's crazy. It's extraordinary that even when you have a military man at the head, he still has distrust for the larger system, and the family is still that place where the Egyptians go to find that safety to protect power. And the mythology reflects this. You've got Osiris protected by his sister wife Isis and other sisters like Nephthys, Selket. You have the understanding of the sun god when he dies going into the body of his mother slash lover who bears him again in the morning. And there is this understanding of the strong, willful, educated female woman who can act on behalf of something larger than herself. And the Egyptians are also quite clear in their mythologies, and it's pretty clear in the history, that these women, if they rule for long periods of time, like Hatshepsut, like Cleopatra, they never rule alone. They always rule with a male entity alongside them in some capacity. And these are the kinds of patterns that I'm working through. That's not to say, for my critics, that Hatshepsut wasn't badass, that Cleopatra wasn't a brilliant strategic thinker. These things are absolutely true, But the patriarchal system cannot just be ignored. We can't positivistically look at this and say, oh, wow, they could have done anything they wanted. No one can do anything they want. Not Putin, not Trump, not you, not me, no one. Not a president of Harvard. No one can do whatever it is they want. We all work within the larger system that we are a part of. And that's my more systems-based thinking. And then how do women fit into that? And I just did, and then I'm going to stop talking and let you ask your next question. But I just wrote a discussion of how we understand this power in a much more theoretical way. So when I'm teaching women in power in the ancient world at UCLA, I use Michael Mann's social theories of power. And he's written a book. Anyway, Michael Mann, social historian, has separated up social power into four parts: ideological, economic, military, and political. I find that extraordinarily useful. They all overlap. They all work with one another. It's the most useful method of understanding how a human can fit into a larger system that I have found. However, and he says this right up front in the beginning of his volume, Systems of Social Power, I think, he says that he's not talking about gender. He uses the word gender and says that he is specifically not doing that because it's a complicated thing, and he has his reasons, and I go through those in this article that I've just written. And I suggest that we add to this rubric a body element, not a gender element, not a sexual element. Think of how much we're arguing about sexual identity and how that manifests in a human body biologically and how one can choose it culturally or have it assigned culturally. Sexuality is not going to help us. It's too fraught. And I just listened to this whole podcast, the J.K. Rowling one that just came out. Super interesting to have trans perspectives on one side and J.K. Rowling's feminist, we need to protect the woman who is the subservient within a patriarchal society perspective on the other. And both of them have very interesting and valid things to say. If you apply a body element to this Michael Mann system of social power, it accounts for whether you're a child, whether you have dark skin, whether you're a woman who can be impregnated, whether you're a woman who can't be impregnated because you're menopausal and you're old, nobody cares about you anymore, or whether you're a child or whether whatever you are, the disabled, you have body dysmorphia, whatever it is. But this body element then helps to understand who gets to have power, who can be included in society and who isn't. And we are sexually dimorphic primates. And it kind of drives me crazy when feminists try to discount this and say that the body itself can be transcended. I think, Megan, you've had children, I've had children, and we both know what it means to be imprisoned by our bodies and to have our bodies betray us and to have the service that society foists upon us performed through our bodies. And so no one can tell me at this point in my life that my body can be transcended. That's some bullshit right there. So I have a real problem with the feminism in the United States, not in Britain, but in the United States in particular, that really is trying to say that the body itself is a social construct. I do reject that. And in the ancient world, that's not going to work. The ancient world simplifies things to a great extent. There's no gender reassignment surgeries. There's no hormonal therapy. There's what you get and there's what you perceived as. And then there's the place that you're economically and socially foisted into and what you have to do and whom you have to service or act as in your role in society. Sex is a huge part of that. And so I do like to keep it real in terms of how are human bodies, particularly women's impregnable bodies, used as economic extensions of patriarchal power? How are they used as land in a way that is to be sown or livestock that is to be exploited? And that may set a lot of people's teeth on edge. However, that's the way economies in the ancient world, ancient patriarchal world, worked. It may not be a way a hunter-gatherer economy of Southern California works, but it's the way ancient Egypt largely worked. And then there's other things one could talk about, and, you know, like why Egyptian women had a great deal of social power despite this patriarchal system. And I do have an answer for that that involves the economy, but I'll let you ask your next question, or I've talked long enough without an answer or comment.
I was just going to ask, in this system of authoritarian families and a patriarchy that is supported and upheld by the women in those families, how does Cleopatra rise to power and how does she keep that power?
Cleopatra finds her power through the family. It is through that dynasty that she finds her power, and it is particularly through her father that she finds that power. Her father assigns her as a co-ruler because he knows that it's better for him not to rule alone. And this, in the same way that the Ptolemaic kings before him knew that they had to rule alongside a sister wife or a wife daughter or something. And there was always another, almost always another female accompaniment on the throne. It decentralized the onus of power and the danger of power as much as it decentralized the power of power. And so Cleopatra comes through because her father wants her to come through. And she also comes through to power because there's so much internal competition by this point in particular. But certainly this is not the only time when the Ptolemies are eating each other alive. I mean, I don't know why nobody has made a miniseries or series about this family, because it puts the Game of Thrones series to shame. I mean, it's pretty crazy. You're going to send your sister wife's child and your child to her dismembered in a box as a birthday gift. And Ptolemy the Eighth? My Ptolemaic history is not so great. I'm a Bronze and Iron Age girl myself. But she finds her power through her father. And then she finds her power through Rome. And she finds her power through this Roman Senate, who then says, okay, you are going to get to rule. We've read your father's will aloud, and we all agree. So she gets the men's approval from this other place that is not an occupying faction yet, but kind of. They have legions there, right? And they're like, okay, you get to rule, but you have to rule with a brother. And then he goes to war with her, and Julius Caesar's there and all of this stuff. And then she rules with the next brother. When both of these brothers have been eliminated, one through war, the other through an outright assassination at her orders, ostensibly, then she has to rule with the Roman warlords. She still cannot rule alone. Or she has to rule ideologically with her son. So she then assigns another masculine entity to rule with her. And there is no such thing as a woman ruling alone. It doesn't exist. If it does exist, they're eliminated, like Tawasret, or they, like Nefertiti, if she was Menkaure, and wow, you want to start a bar fight with Egyptologists, you know, just mention, say, was Nefertiti Menkaure, and then fists will start flying and beard glasses will be thrown. But like,
say that and then duck quickly.
Exactly. But if she was that, one, she had to hide her identity as something else and masculinize and be something that she was not. It wouldn't be super surprising. And number two, she wasn't there for very long, which makes one suspect that she was eliminated. And given that we know the 18th dynasty ended with a seizure of power by a man, I in this case, who did not place Ankhes and Amun into a position of power as the rest of her 18th dynasty sisters would have been, something shady, in my opinion, is going on. She came to power because the Ptolemies needed female accompaniment to male power in Egypt, in particular, in a way that they did not need it in their Greek or Hellenized homeland. That's interesting. And it says something about Egyptian dynastic authoritarianism and its lack of internal competition that's really interesting. So even when you insert this hyper-competitive Ptolemaic dynasty, because Egyptian dynasties don't promote or seem to show this kind of hyper-competitivism that the Ptolemaic dynasties do, even when you insert that Greek competitiveness, trust no one sort of ideological, economic, social system into Egypt, you still are inserting it into an authoritarian space where there's very little competition from the outside. Yeah, you might have a bread riot here or there, but really, it's not that hard to control the space in comparison to a Greek space or an Athenian city space or a Mesopotamian city state versus another or an Italian peninsula. It's easier to control Egypt. And so then they all end up backbiting each other, interestingly, within a system that they can wield as authoritarians without too much trouble.
All right, I'm going to jump in here with one and kind of bounce off of that a little bit and also try to relate it back to the film. Let's see if I can do it, if it works. So yeah, it's interesting because I always thought that the, you know, it's interesting in the casting choices, right? You have like fiery Elizabeth Taylor, and then you have like the older statesman. I think it's, what's his name? Rex Harrison, whatever his name is.
I love Rex Harrison. He's the best.
Yeah. So he's like a stately sort of older Caesar. And then you have, what's his name? Mark Antony.
Richard Burton.
Yes. Thank you.
No worries. I'm here all day.
So obviously what we see in the film is quite interesting because, you know, she's gorgeous and whatever. And you're like, okay, kind of like not, kind of like great looking men, but also interesting dichotomy with the ages. But in real life, though, isn't it true that like Cleopatra was not supposed to be this raging beauty? And so she kept the men with the power of her mind. And so just looking at it in a sort of modern context, you know, I'm wondering if you could expand on like, so how did she actually manage to, like, was it just that she was so smart and they were so attracted to it? There's got to be something else, right? It can't just be like, you know, not very pretty woman. I mean, is it the power? Is it that she occupies the space? Like, what is it? Why did they stay with her?
Oh, there's so much more to it. And it defines Rome and it creates the Principate, in my opinion. It is Egypt and the seduction of this unassailable authoritarianism that seduces Julius Caesar and ends up causing his downfall and all those stabs at the Senate. And it seduces Marcus Antonius and pulls him into that idea that he too can be a king of the world, even though the Romans have rejected this kingship. It is Egypt that turns Rome into the authoritarianism they profess to hate. It is these great men who are in constant competition against one another, war after war, and really destructive stuff. All of the money wasted, all of the different leagues and different strategies and different triumvirates and how are we going to work this out? It is a relief to people and to, it seems, the leadership as well that, okay, let's just do it this way. Let's take a page from the Book of Egypt and try to understand how they did it. And when I started to really understand this, I was at the Getty, actually, another place of competition with authoritarianism overlaying it, interestingly. But I was there at the Beyond the Nile exhibition, and I'm looking at two gray wacky stone statues, one supposedly of Marcus Antonius, Mark Antony, the other one supposedly of Julius Caesar. Neither one of them labeled as such, but the portraits are distinct enough that classical art historians are like, yep, that's what we think they are. This is Mark Antony. This is Julius Caesar. And they're using this green stone and they have inlaid eyes. And they're, I think both of them in private collection or one of them is in a private collection. I'd have to look it up. But this stone is an Osirian stone. It's an Egyptian stone. It's a stone associated with the green. It is greenish gray. It is associated with the green of Egypt's land, of its fecundity, its ability to grow wheat, barley, to make beer and all of these things. I mean, it's so easily done here versus Greece or Rome versus Europe. And it is a stone that also speaks to gold, because the Wadi Hammamat, where gray wacky comes from, is a gold mine. It's still a gold mine. And you can get copper here, you can get gold here. And when a king is making a statue out of gray wacky, yes, they're saying, I'm like Osiris and I'm like the fecundity of the grain. But he's also saying, I am the one who controls the money. I am the one who controls the resources. I have it all. It is an unspoken code. And it may seem like a step removed, but trust me, the Egyptians would have gotten it. They would have understood, the elite Egyptians. And the Romans would have gotten it. They're like, oh, it's that stone where the gold comes from and da, da, da. Okay. Green stone is something that people understood as lucky, as full of wealth, as associated with Venus and great riches. So to depict yourself in this green stone is to say that I am of Egypt. And for these Romans to do this and to go to this other place and to then become Egyptian in a sense, or become like Egyptian kings. Now, Julius Caesar didn't get to develop into this because he was killed for his audacity and inviting Cleopatra to Rome and having a child with her, of building a dynasty with her. And Mark Antony, he goes much further in his experiment with what it means to flirt or play or just go in league with authoritarianism. And the Romans see this. They're like, they've lost their good Roman values. And so much of the propaganda that's written about Cleopatra is trying to apologize for these men and to say that they didn't mean it. They didn't really understand. And how can you best do that? By bringing your misogyny out and saying that it was Cleopatra who seduced them. It was Cleopatra's beauty and charm and strategy that got them to do these stupid, stupid things. When really, it's just the system of Egypt, which is so freaking rich and so seductive in allowing these men to completely overpower their enemies. And they say this in the film too, you know, how do we invade Parthia? What do we need? We need some money. Where do we get that money? We get it from Egypt. Cleopatra is a cipher. But, and here I'm going to get a little patriarchal, Cleopatra knows like anybody else, you have to have legacy and longevity to hold power. She uses these men as sperm donors to create a dynasty of her own. And if she weren't taken out by Octavian, because yes, I do think he killed her. I do not think she committed suicide. If she were not taken out by Octavian, she would have been able to create a dynasty in a way that no other female ruler of Egypt was able to do. But then she wouldn't have been ruling alone, but there's no way the Roman war machine is going to stand for this. It can't. And so she has to be eliminated, and everyone else has to be eliminated as well. They do it in some ways. Eliminating a woman is a tricky thing. Outright killing her is a problem from the Roman ideological perspective. So having her commit suicide, taking a man's hero's way out and leaving her people in the lurch, unlike what a mother would do, is the best misogynistic tale to tell. So all of this stuff that we talk about, her beauty, was she pretty, was she not? Was she smart, was she not? Was she drama prone or not? It doesn't matter. She could be all of these things. They're coming to Egypt because Egypt gives them what? It gives them shit ton of money in terms of grain and resources, stone, metals, precious metals, gold. And it gives them authoritarianism unlike anywhere else in the world because its economic and political system works as such. And the Romans wanted it and needed it. And that's why they went there. This is so sad for me to say, but it's like she doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter. So the film, like you said, really emphasizes Egypt as a place of wealth and a source of grain. What does Egypt historically get out of this relationship with Rome and with the outside world?
Well, it gets its demise. So we have to think in short term versus long term now, don't we? And we have to assume that Cleopatra was also thinking short term versus long term. She knew she couldn't rule with her brothers who were trying to kill her. Her father's dead. There's no one left. She could have tried to marry somebody from the Macedonian extended family of Alexander the Great someplace else, bringing him into her court. That would have been very problematic. I think she identified, and here we can see some of her short-term strategy, she identified the players on the board with the most to gain from her, who would come to her, and she identified the players on the board with the most willingness to blow shit up and to come to her with their militaries to do what she wanted. So she could also use them as protection, which she did, to bring herself out of exile, which she did, to expand her territories, which she did, both politically, diplomatically, and through warfare. She needed warriors. She needed men in this political arena who would be able to act as a protector. And without any menfolk around her within the patriarchal world she was occupying, she needed a way to say, I can rule alone. And being impregnated by one of these warlords and then having the child grow up next to her, a young man, so that she can sit there like Hatshepsut did with Thutmose III and say, I am only protecting him. This is not for me. This is not my deal. This is his. It allows her, in the Egyptian sense, it makes perfect sense. And then Cleopatra must have realized, and you wonder when, oh no, what have I done? Because by having a child with one of these Roman warlords who's now been eliminated. And I think she was probably very surprised by that. Not that her own brothers hadn't been eliminated. They had been. Maybe, why should she be surprised? It was a dangerous world that she grew up in to be. It was not an easy thing to be king in the late Ptolemaic world. But when he's eliminated, she's got a serious problem because now her son is she needs to keep him associated with Roman, yet not. And that's essentially what draws the target on her back. And then having all of these children with Mark Antony, same thing. You have competitive Rome doesn't go away. And competitive Rome, even with the Principate, does not go away. The Principate is able to arbiter it in a more clear fashion, but the competitiveness is still there. It just works in a different way, and it works outwardly in a better way. So you're able to go into other territories and move your competitiveness into outer regions of this imperial space rather than eat each other alive. But what was your question again? It was why
it was what Egypt gets out of the relationship with Rome.
Oh, yeah. So she gets a short-term protection. She gets to rule. She's the last ruler, and she needs to have a kid to continue after her. And if she'd been able to bring Ptolemy up, then she would have had a ruler after her. We also have to remember that in hindsight for us, we're like, oh my God, she was so stupid. What was she thinking? But the Ptolemaic dynasty had lasted for almost 300 years at this point. None of the kings had been killed by Rome. They'd been working with Rome for some time. I think this was something that was unexpected, but it was her big, bold moves by integrating and aligning herself with parts of Rome that took Ptolemy out. It's a double-edged sword, obviously. Her going in gets her short-term protection, but her having those children with those Roman warlords then means her demise. There was no way out of it. And she must have known that at some point, that this is the end for me.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you can only cover so much, and already the film is too long. It's like 4 hours long, so they don't want to put any more.
I couldn't finish it.
It's too long. But it's interesting.
With such soliloquies. They're like, let's have him have the longest speech and then shots of her. And then another longest speech and shots
I did of her. Watch the movie and on like 1.5 speed because I can't sit and watch something for that long. And it did lead to some comical moments because the long looks were a reasonable amount of time, but it was a little bit amusing because then the music speeds up as well. And it's just like, it's fun. But yeah, my top tip, if you have to watch a really, really long movie, just speed it up a bit.
Megan knows this. My attention span does wander, but for this film in particular, I do sit and I do like to watch the whole thing because I can't speed up Alex North's beautiful score that accompanies it. So anything distracting from that would be hard. But anyway,
and you get to stare at Richard Burton's legs and his little short
skirts are very short.
The mini skirts are very short. Why are they so short? I don't know why they're so short. Costuming question for later, someone else.
But that's why Mel Brooks and The Life of Brian, they make them so extraordinarily short, which is just brilliant because you know what they're making fun of. And I love it. I love it.
I would still venture a guess that they're not quite as short as the ones we've seen in Ulysses 54, I think, with Kirk Douglas. They were, really short.
Like, getting shorter. Necessary blurring territory right there.
Okay. Well, short men's skirts aside, they still, with a 4-hour runtime, did not put, I mean, you don't really see in the film, like, what happens to Caesarion. You know, she sends him away and she's like, okay, go be over here and I'm going to go die tragically. So obviously there's rumors that he was killed when he was caught.
But they kind of mentioned it because there's a part where she says, I swear on the life of my son. And you know, they cut something. I swear on the life of my son, which means she knows that Octavian's killed the boy already.
There were significant looks there as well.
Yes. So there was something there. And if you knew the story, you're like, oh, boy's dead. So there it is. She would never swear on the life of her son otherwise. So something got cut. A lot got cut.
But yeah, you know, that's her being smart, being like, this is the chess match where he's like, do you promise to not kill yourself so I can take you back to Rome? But then you can rule again. So she's like, yeah, I swear on the life of my son, who's what we know and she knows is dead. He's not going to hold his word. And if he lies about it, then she's like, yeah, I'm going to die right here. But why would it not have been advantageous for him to, instead of like kill the child, take him back? And I'm assuming he was pretty young enough that maybe you could still brainwash him into being like a nice ally. Or did that sort of just end? And was it easier to be like, let me just take over Egypt myself, make it a full on province and not even keep ostensibly a member of the Ptolemies here?
Well, remember that the Ptolemies were only allowed to be there because the competition in Rome was so fierce. And anyone who even flirted with the idea of taking over Egypt was eliminated like that, right? Because anyone who had Egypt had the power, had the grain, had the gold, had everything they needed to pay their soldiers. This is why Julius Caesar is eliminated. This is why Mark Antony is eliminated. And when Octavian is able to take it, that's when the authoritarianism is cemented. It is Egypt that cements Rome's authoritarian power going forward and that allows it. So it has to be made a province to be controlled by a governor who is going to be directly connected to the imperator in the Principate. So this is the way it has to work. It's only allowed to be a diplomatic proxy rule so that it lessens the competition in the 100 years leading up to it, or 300 years leading up to this moment, arguably.
I have one more question, and then all of my questions are done. The movie makes a really big point of kind of emphasizing Cleopatra as a Macedonian. Do we have any ideas, because the Ptolemies have been there, like you said, for 300 years by this point. Do we have any ideas of how Cleopatra may have conceptualized her own identity?
Oh, you're hitting the hornet's nest with a baseball bat.
And also, I might love it.
So, because as everyone knows, the identity of Cleopatra has been much in the news lately with that Netflix drama documentary that the Egyptian government and Ministry of Antiquities lost their heads over, because the woman in that documentary who plays Cleopatra is a mixed race, mixed African, mixed white, arguably, woman. And people are like, how dare they? Cleopatra was white. And they use these words like white. And the woman in the documentary, she looks very Egyptian, which is interesting. She looks Southern Egyptian, maybe a woman of Luxor, like a Hatshepsutian sort of Egyptian. But it brings up the question of identity. And if you read somebody like Rawler's biography of Cleopatra, he says without any footnote or anything that she was half or a quarter Egyptian, which is really interesting. And the reason he's saying that, and I actually do agree with him, is because Cleopatra spoke and read Egyptian. And she is the only Ptolemaic ruler to have spoken and read Egyptian. This is not an easy language to learn. It is an exclusionary language. It is something that people who study and track language as it moves know that it often moves with women, because women are teaching their children in the household a particular language. And if you're bringing women folk with you, you could bring a language with you for a certain number of generations or something like that. But the idea that Cleopatra speaks and reads Egyptian and is the first one, and the fact that her mother is not identified clearly in any way, makes me suspect that Ptolemy the 12th had some sort of affair with an Egyptian woman. And remember, the Ptolemies are meant to be monogamous. And what a ridiculous way of running an authoritarian regime from an Egyptian perspective. It's just stupid. You got to have a good harem to spread your chances, you know, be able to roll the dice and get something that wins. But anyway, Henry VIII had the same problem. It doesn't work out. So Cleopatra's mother was almost certainly Egyptian in my mind, but we'll never know. But the fact that they don't tell us is useful information, because it's never explicitly stated to be a Cleopatra the Fifth. And so that means this, well, then you have to ask, okay, where would this woman have been from? And if she's a Delta woman, which is the most likely, then she's probably not going to look like a Luxor woman and have extremely dark skin. But Cleopatra probably was certainly not as white as Elizabeth Taylor, and was not, in my opinion, pure Macedonian. And after 300 years of Macedonian affairs, because there's no way that the amount of full brother-sister marriage that they demonstrate performatively is going to actually result in children after that many generations. They had to have brought in other genetic material in the form of women and women's bodies. Many of those women's bodies in occupied Egypt would have been Egyptian. So she may have had more Egyptian than a quarter or half. And there's no way for us to know until we, I don't know, find the tomb of Cleopatra. Isn't somebody looking at Taposiris Magna? But, you know, and even then, try doing a DNA study for race and ethnicity and talk about more people's heads exploding. These are not easy topics. But in short, it shows how we all want to claim Egypt, that we're still like Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, wanting our own gray, wacky statues that show us that we're rich and awesome, that we want to say, oh, Cleopatra was white like us in the 60s by putting Elizabeth Taylor in that role. And the Egyptians now are saying, no, well, she's not like Elizabeth Taylor, but she would have been white and owned that whiteness as well. And in a post-colonial sense, want to identify with that whiteness and become extremely defensive. Even when somebody puts somebody in a documentary, which is a shitty documentary, by the way, who looks Egyptian. And then you're like, well, why are you speaking against Cleopatra potentially being part Egyptian? But in a post-colonial sense, the whiteness is still where the power is. So it's just a really interesting way of seeing how identity works within patriarchal systems of claims and counterclaims and Afrocentrism getting thrown in there for fun. It's all just patriarchal pissing contests of claims and saying who's got power and control when we're never going to really know. And it wasn't important for her to make these claims.
I feel like that's a great tagline just for ancient history in general, a patriarchal pissing contest. You're welcome, internet.
Very fitting. Well, one thing that always strikes me, and I don't know if it's just a casting choice, it could be as simple as that, but every time I watch, I always make a mental note of it. She has a handmaiden who's very clearly Asian. And I was like, okay, this could be a casting choice. But it's interesting because they put the Asian one also in the specific...
And East Asia.
She's specifically
because,
like,
you know, West Asia's right there.
Well, she's specifically the one also who like hands her the poisoned cup and then gets caught and then dies, which also I have many issues with, but that is an aside. But knowing how extensive trade networks were, I was like, well, that's not impossible. But also as not an expert in Egypt, I'm like, oh, that's kind of far. So you being the expert in Egypt, would there have been like East Asian people there?
I think they just, Hollywood didn't have a whole lot of Middle Easterners in their stable, that's the word that is used in the patriarchal system, of artists to hire. And I think it was just like a person's got darker skin, let's just take them on, no one will notice. That's what I suspect. I don't think the casting director is alive for us to ask, but that's my guess. But I have no idea.
It's okay. I don't think we're meant to. I just was like, I want to know why there's like a Chinese woman here when she would have been very far, and that's a long way to go.
But speaking of race and ethnicity in this film, there are many things to notice, like the scene when she is, that famous scene when she is brought into Rome with the weird Sphinx thing that everyone's pulling. Never would have happened, this weird, is it metal? What the hell? And Rex Harrison is like, look at my boy all unafraid on top of the big scary Sphinx. You know, it's so cute. His paternal love for his bastard boy. But, and I'm only using the word bastard within the patriarchal system. Please don't misunderstand me. I think bastards are awesome. But the men carrying and pulling that big Sphinx have the blackest of black skin. And you know they hired a bunch of African actors and then put the African actors in black body paint, like a black and blackface. So they wanted to show her as a racist plantation owning exploiter of people, and wanted to show Egypt in that way too. And they wanted to juxtapose that with the Rome of noble citizens who would never do such a thing. It's a very North versus South trope, American style, like how do we understand an Alabama versus New York through the lens of California kind of look. And I found that very interesting as well.
A lot of the costuming and the casting of the extras was all very, very interesting stuff. Very interesting. Lexi and I talked about the head eunuch who gets killed pretty early on, executed, I believe. And the fact that he's in like baby blue and light pink clothing.
Very
feminizing colors.
Eunuch-y. Yeah. The costuming is insane. I mean, just if one could get screenshots of all of the costumes that she's wearing, the costume designer must have lost their mind with the amount that they had to create, and the makeup artist as well. I mean, it's insane. And I also enjoyed how sometimes she would be masculinized and sometimes she would be feminized. Sometimes boobies out, sometimes boobies in. And sometimes she looked pretty and sometimes her hair couldn't be seen. And she just looked like she was bald-headed, strange old man look. And it's hard to pull off a bald look when you're wearing a pseudo red crown or whatever the hell that felt thing was. But like, you know, it was cool to see her acting in these ways, using her body in some ways, and then her feminine wiles, and then going all masculine, a woman who can have it all. And look at how dangerous this is. Definitely a cautionary tale to note.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, I could go on about costuming choices in this, but also weird set design and the whole, it never ceases to amaze me, the platform thing they bring her down to Caesar in. I was like, that was not a thing. That looks like it has hinges and things that were not invented.
None of it's right. None of it is ever right. The palaces aren't right. It's not right in Prince of Egypt, which is the one that's the closest to being right. The palaces aren't right. The temples aren't right. Where people are standing isn't right. What the Nile looks like isn't right. With the vegetation and isn't right. Assassin's Creed, same thing. And there's like oak trees and shit all over. I'm like, what are you guys doing? Why are people fighting with swords? This is
why them mangoes.
It's those details are never right. You know, more donkeys, less camels. We need all of these things.
I mean, you would think a film with a budget this big, and if they're going to go making it this long, you could at least make it more historically accurate. But you know, yeah,
it went on eyeliner.
Yes,
so much eyeliner. So much eyeliner and different and sparkly glitter. I don't know where they got
it was
that
amazing.
Glitter.
If nothing else, it's a feast for the eyes.
It is.
That's true.
It is.
Well, I was going to say, do we have any final thoughts on the film stuff before we wrap generally with Cleopatra?
Nothing from me. I think we've covered everything I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, basically, I would say in wrapping the film, at least, it's very long. So you would want to sit down if you have that attention span or put it on and then do laundry or something.
Yeah, do laundry, do something else. But it doesn't suck, you know?
It could be worse.
And it's funny. It's funny in parts. And I read a little bit of the backstory and I watched a couple of extra scenes last night. And there's the one where slap each other. Slap, slap, slap. Slap! And apparently he slapped her back and it was a real slap and she slapped him for real. And they were also arguing with each other and like during in real life, right? IRL. And then this slapping back and forth. And so watch that scene at least. That's just YouTube that scene. And you're like, damn.
I have to go and YouTube that now because that sounds amazing.
It is amazing. And then they cut to her on the floor and falling beautifully, you know, on the floor. This is not real, but the slap apparently was real. And you wonder how much that happened in real life.
I think I told Megan last time, one of my favorite scenes is the one where they're on the barge when he's begging her for money. And then she stages that like weird pseudo-realistic play of actors playing them. And then he gets mad and then like barges into her room. And she's just wearing like a necklace of Caesar coins. And I'm like, what?
Why?
That wasn't real, right? Like, why would they? I was like, okay. And then she like dramatically rips it off. Or no, doesn't he dramatically rip it off of her?
She
I
does,
think.
Yeah. It's symbolizing the transfer of ownership of her body from Julius Caesar to Mark Anthony.
Wild metaphors.
That's
man.
How I choose to understand it.
And we have to remember that Egypt was like deeply in debt during this time. And if Roman propagandists have any, if there's any truth to her showing up in Tarsus and the barge that she showed up in and with, you know, this amount of wealth being displayed, she's doing it to save herself. She's doing it to make sure that she can lure this Roman warlord in and be like, look how rich I am, dude. You need me. And he's like, I do need you. And she's the one who probably needs him for protection from people internally. Who knows what kind of people are trying to take her power? So,
I mean, it's very in line with her demanding a third of the Roman Empire when he's like, I can't give you that. And she's like, well, then I'm just going to take my rich barge and leave. And he's like, no. Okay, good.
But the film presents it as if her wealth is this unlimited thing that she squanders. And of course, the Roman propagandists do the same, but historians know the reality to be different. But why you can't get that right, I don't understand. Kind of drives
I know.
Me crazy. How hard is that, Hollywood, to tell a nuanced story about people in difficult straits who are trying to get shit done and are like, how can I get a Roman warlord to protect me? And things are really bad. Why can't people have agendas of protection on both sides or agendas? Anyway, drives me crazy.
It was, I remember always pointing out, it's strange that they get like certain details that would be so easy to get correct wrong, but then they also do show that like the Library of Alexandria did get burned in one of the initial attacks. And I was like, well, that's yes, but why is that in here and not something else that is right? I don't understand. Hollywood confuses me.
Yeah. Well, they are going with cultural memory. They're going with a Shakespearean cultural memory more than anything else, in my opinion.
Well, I'm sure that we could probably find much more, but we'll have to leave it there. Megan, I will let you close us out, though.
Thank you both very much, Cara. This is really interesting. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, my my pleasure. It's always so much fun to talk to you guys.
Oh, no, it's a delight. And we will see you all next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. Don't forget to leave us a review, and you can also follow us on social media at The Reading Party Podcast. If you'd like to leave us a book or movie suggestion, then email us at thereadingpartypod@gmail.com. See you next week.